Timaeus and Critias of Plato constitute not only the fullest, but by far the most important body of historical evidence regarding Atlantis which we possess. Now, there is no subject that I know of in the world with more books written about it than Atlantis. I could pick about any I wanted, but this is one out of my library, The History of Atlantis by Spence. Lewis Spence. Now, I'm not just teaching on the pyramid and teaching on Stonehenge because they're interesting. I live to communicate the validity of God's Word. And I'm tired of the book that has endured the centuries of skepticism being put down. Now, most ministries, including those on TV, cannot survive unless they keep people stirred up with some project. In the now going on 13 years that I've been here, I've had very few projects. You know, we got an uplink once in a mobile studio, but even there we ask you to give for the teaching as a testimonial of the value of the teaching, and only if you've taught or been taught, rather, and want to make a testimonial to its value. We took a major step of faith in something that was out of character for me. My ministry has never been characterized by stone and steel and glass structures. But the importance of this city, Los Angeles, to this country that is so important in God's plan for the last days, and the importance of preserving a testimonial to God's presence in this city, made us commit ourselves to saving the last historic church in the heart of Los Angeles. And it cost us dearly. And we're still recovering from that. But the wrecking ball hasn't hit it yet. Now the world cannot understand why we would take those steps. And a lot of people remember that I said when we started, better to try and fail than not to try at all. And God is not yet finished in that which He is doing on that issue. Neither is God finished in judging the motives and acts of all who have been involved in this sincere effort to save that church. Now, it ain't over, it's over, and the last chapter hasn't been written, but I want to place that activity in perspective. I'm not just a little bit disappointed at the number of people who were aroused to give, even though I clearly said there were no strings and the giving was because of the teaching, and to give to preserve a monument on the scene of time to testify to the enduring power of God's Word and the preservation of a stone-faced church that had inscribed over its portals, "Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven." But I'm not just a little bit disturbed that the reality is that a lot of people gave more intensely for that visible project than they did before or since to the intangible, intrinsic, unseen goal of being a voice in these last days to communicate God's word that sets men free and roadmaps them into eternity. In my finer moments, I never have any regrets. In my less than finer moments, I have questions and even anger. But in my finer moments, I never have any regrets for taking our stand. And we have saved that testimonial to God's word while being dumped on constantly for the effort. Now, I was approached this past week for a Jewish synagogue that is a historic monument. And they need $20,000 for the first step of saving it. I didn't hesitate a minute to say, we'll pick up 10% of that. And I've been praying about it. I may pick up the whole $20,000. I need to talk to the city councilman that represents the district. I'm quite sure there'll be people in that Jewish congregation that will say, tear it down, take the money and go somewhere else. I want it to be known in this city of Los Angeles that Gene Scott has only begun to fight to preserve the historic religious monuments in this city of the messenger. That's what angels means. And maybe somewhere it will dawn on those shallow thinkers who forever analyze my activity that I did an undergraduate major in history, a PhD in philosophies of education at Stanford University, and I do not come by my philosophic and historic perspective as a sometime affair of current convenience. I have watched Los Angeles and the West Coast tear down historic monuments. And I have traveled this world from the high Andes to a jungle church on the tip of the main island of Tahiti to the great cathedrals of Europe and came to appreciate the symbols in time that speak of God's presence, and properly understood the pyramid and Stonehenge and other things that I'm teaching about are witnesses on the stage of time of God's presence in the affairs of men. And these symbols are not to be taken lightly. Now, don't be surprised if I commit myself to pick up the tab for the $20,000 to save a Jewish synagogue. It's in danger of being torn down in the city of Los Angeles. Every city that I'm in across this nation owes a debt to Los Angeles because Los Angeles pays the bill to take this teaching into every city. And there are intrinsic values that people have quit giving for that I beat the drum about. And as always, I sure will not raise any money for anything other than my teaching. And you can be very sure I won't raise any money to save the Jewish synagogue. Otherwise, I would be quickly criticized for using a Jewish synagogue that is in danger of being torn down as a lever to raise money. When we raised money for the library, we didn't process any of the money, and we didn't deduct anything for expenses, and there is a standing offer to the city to conduct a telethon every year until the library is fully restored. The next move is theirs. They want to pick up that shit. But don't be surprised if I take on the project of helping to protect a Jewish synagogue. And I'm saying all of that while at the same time saying, no matter what degree we involve ourselves in those activities and expressing our responsibility to the place that God has determined will be home for this ministry, though the world is our parish, I will die a broken-hearted pastor and preacher and teacher if somewhere the people that I teach cannot be motivated to give better as a testimonial to the value of the teaching than for some earthly project that we ought to do under our arm as a testimonial act about once a year. But the undergirdings of our ministry should be from people who can see into the sphere of eternity and live with the breath of eternity on them and have come to sense that God's Word is the most precious thing that they can have as the gift to understand it, because it's a sign that God has chosen you as one of those lucky ones that He's given the eyes to see and the ears to hear the unsearchable riches of His Word. Now, I teach on these subjects of the pyramid and Stonehenge and Atlantis because, properly understood, they will prove the frame of reference of the Bible in the antediluvian world and are much more consistent to the biblical view of occasional cataclysms that are the outpouring of God's wrath and the degeneration of man as he was separated from the source of life in contact with God because of the wall of partition between God and man. Man continued to get worse until the light of the gospel shined on this globe, and with all of the problems and Satan's substitutes in the Dark Ages, man has still continued to get better since the light of the gospel shined into this world. And I have one mission, and that's to teach in a way that proves up the validity of God's Word. Now, tonight, because I can't really adequately teach about the pyramid and about Stonehenge without also bringing up Atlantis periodically, I'd like to get into that tonight a little. The Timaeus and Critias of Plato constitute not only the fullest, but by far the most important body of historical evidence regarding Atlantis which we possess. As the available translations of those passages in Plato's work which have reference to Atlantis seem to leave a good deal to be desired, I have carefully compiled a new version of them, basing my account of the Timaeus on the translations of Jowett from the Dialogues of Plato and of R.D. Archerhind, and founding my version of the Critias on that of Jolibois and his dissertation on Atlantis and the French, and the excellent French translation of Negris, the question of the Atlantis of Plato, also in French. This is one of the Each one of these books on Atlantis have their own contribution, and this is probably the best contribution of this particular book, is his carefully compiled version of Plato's story. By careful collation of these translations, I believe I have produced an account which will prove of greater general use to students of the Atlantean problem than any at present existing in English. And I'm inclined to agree with him. It's a marvelous version that he has produced. This account must not be regarded as a translation, but rather as a compilation of translations of the Platonic account of Atlantis. At the same time, I have taken all due care to avoid doing violence in any way to the original, which in the following pages is not rendered in its entirety, though very nearly so, no fact of importance having been omitted. Now, that means what I'm about to read is much like Philip's translation of the New Testament, for example. Plato's account of the Timaeus is in dialogue form. Socrates, Hermocrates, Critias, and Timaeus have foregathered for the purpose of philosophical debate. And Socrates reminds Critias that he promised them a tale which might prove acceptable, quote, for the festival of the goddess. Hermocrates. Indeed, Socrates, as Timaeus said, we will do our utmost, nor can we excuse ourselves from the promise. Yesterday, indeed, on leaving this place, when we reached the guest chamber at the house of Critias, where we are staying, we were discussing this very matter. Critias then told us a story from old tradition, which you had better repeat now, Critias, to Socrates, that he may help us to judge whether it will answer our purpose. Critias. Agreed, if Timaeus is pleased. Timaeus. I quite agree. Critias. Listen then, Socrates, to a tale which, strange though it be, is yet perfectly true. As Solon, the wisest of the seven, once said, he was a relation and friend of Dropidas, my great-grandfather, as he tells us himself in his poems. And Dropidas assured my grandfather, Critias, who, when an old man, repeated it to us that there were great and marvelous exploits achieved by Athens in the days of old, which through lapse of time and in the course of generations have vanished from memory. The most remarkable is one which it would be fitting for us to narrate. And so at once discharge our debt of gratitude to you, and also praise the goddess at the time of her festival by a paean in her honor. Socrates, a capital proposal. But what was this feat which Critias described on the authority of Solon as actually performed of old by this city, though unrecorded in history? Critias, I will tell you an old story which I heard from an aged man. For Critias was then nearly 90 years of age when I was about 10. It happened to be the children's day of the Apaturia, which was a festival in honor of Dionysius, held in October. It happened to be the children's day of the Apaturia, and as was customary, the boys enjoyed their pastime, our fathers giving us rewards for declaiming poetry. Much poetry by several authors was recited, and since that of Solon had the virtue of novelty, many of the children sang his poems. Then one of the kinsmen remarked, whether he believed so or merely wished to please Critias, that he considered that Solon was not only the wisest of mankind, but also the greatest of all poets. Turn me up a little. The old man was gratified and said, smiling, "Yes, Amenandros, if he had not regarded poetry merely as a side issue, but had addressed himself seriously to it, and if he had completed the account which he carried from Egypt, instead of being compelled to leave it unwritten by reason of the troubles which he found here on his return, I'm of the opinion that had he done that, that neither Hesiod nor Homer nor any other poet would have enjoyed so much fame as he." "What account was that, Croesus?" asked Amenandros. "It referred to a mighty achievement," he replied, "and one which deserved to be exalted throughout the world. A great deed which our city actually performed. But owing to time and the destruction of the doers thereof, the story has not come down to our days." "Tell us from the beginning," said the other, "the tale that Solon told, and how and from whom he received it as true." "There is in Egypt," said Croesus, "in the delta, at the head of which the river Nile divides, a province called Sais. And the chief city of this province is also Sais, the birthplace of Amasis, the king. The founder of this city is a goddess whose name in the Egyptian tongue is Neith, and in Greek, as the Egyptians say, Athena. The people of Sais are great lovers of the Athenians and claim a certain kinship with us. Now, when Solon sojourned in this city, he was most honorably entreated by its people, and when he inquired concerning ancient things of the priests, who were the most learned therein, he found that neither he nor any other Greek knew anything about such matters. And when he wished to lead them on to talk of ancient times, he told them of the oldest legends of Greece, of Pheronius, who was called the first man, and of Niobe, of the tale of Deucalion and Pyrrha, how they survived after the deluge. And he reckoned up their descendants and tried by calculating the periods to count up the number of years that had passed during the events he related. Then said one of the priests, a man well stricken in years, "Oh, Solon, Solon, ye Greeks are but children, and there is no Grecian who is an old man." And when Solon heard this, he said, "What mean you by this?" And the priest said, "Ye are all young in your souls, for ye have not any old tradition, any ancient belief nor knowledge that is hoary with age." And that's why we want to save churches in Los Angeles. Just thought I'd put that in. "And the reason of this, or the reason of it is this, many have been the destructions of mankind, and many shall be. The greatest are by fire and by water. But besides these, the fire and water ones, there are lesser ones. For indeed the tale that is also told among you, how that Phaethon yoked his father's chariot, and for that he could not drive in his father's path, he burnt up all things upon earth and was himself smitten by a thunderbolt and slain. This story has the air of a fable. But the truth concerning it is related to a deviation of the bodies that move round the earth and the heavens, whereby at long intervals of time a destruction through fire of the things that are upon the earth occurs. Thus do those who dwell on mountains and in high places and in dry perish more easily than those who live beside rivers and by the sea. Now the Nile, which is our preserver, saves us also from this distress by releasing his springs. But when the gods send a flood upon the earth, not fire, lustrating her with waters, those in the mountains are saved. Just the opposite. The neatherds and the shepherds. But the inhabitants of the cities in your land are swept by the rivers into the sea. But in this land at no time does water fall upon the fields. But the reverse occurs, and all rises up by nature from below. Wherefore the legends preserved here are the most ancient on record. The truth is that in all places where great cold or heat does not forbid, there are ever human beings, now more, now fewer. Now, whether at Athens or in Egypt or in any other known place, anything noble or great or otherwise notable has occurred, we have written down and preserved an account of it from ancient times in our temples here. But with you and other nations, the commonwealth has only just been discovered. The use of letters and the other commodities that cities require, and after the wonted term of years, like a recurring sickness, comes rushing on them the torrent from heaven, and it leaves only the unlettered and untaught among you, so that, as it were, ye become young again with a new birth, knowing naught of what happened in ancient times, either in our country or in yours. For example, these genealogies, Solon, which you just now recounted of the people in your country, are little better than children's tales. For in the first place, ye remember but one deluge, whereas there had been many before it. The Bible speaks of at least one. Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1:2, King James says, and the earth was without form and void. Well, that contradicts exactly what Jeremiah says. But Jeremiah says the opposite. He presented it, or he created it, not a waste and a desolation. And any student of the Hebrew knows the second chapter, or the second verse of Genesis 1, can just as legitimately be translated, instead of, and the earth was without form and void, it can just as legitimately be translated, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. Then it says, waters covered the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. So we know at least one deluge prior to the Noah flood. Nobody knows what went on between Genesis 1:1, the vast eons of time, and Genesis 1:2, when the earth became a waste and a desolation. For example, these genealogies, Solon, which you just now recounted from the people of your country, back to reading, are little better than children's tales. For in the first place, ye remember but one deluge, whereas there have been many before it. And again, ye know, now that the fairest and noblest race among mankind lived once in your country, whence ye sprang, and all your city, which now is from a very little seed, that of old was left over. Ye know it not, because the survivors died, or rather, you know it not, because the survivors lived and died for many generations without utterance and writing. For once upon a time, Solon, far back beyond the greatest destruction by waters, that which is now the city of the Athenians was foremost both in war and in all besides, and her laws were exceedingly righteous above all cities. Her deeds and her government are said to have been the noblest whereof the report has come to our ears. And Solon said that on hearing this, he was astonished and used all urgency in entreating the priest to relate to him from beginning to end all about these ancient citizens. So the priest said, O Solon, I will tell it for thy sake and for the sake of thy city and for the honor of the goddess who was the owner and nurse and instructress both of your city and of ours. For she founded yours earlier by 1,000 years, having taken the seed of you from earth and Hephaistos and ours in later time. And the date of our city's foundation is recorded in our sacred writings to be 8,000 years ago. But concerning the citizens of Athens, 9,000 years ago, I will briefly inform you of their laws and of the noblest of the deeds which they performed. The precise truth concerning everything we will examine in due order hereafter, taking the actual records at our leisure. Regard the Hellenic laws in comparison with those of Egypt, for you will find here at the present day many examples of the laws which then existed among you. First, the separation of the priestly caste from the rest. Next, the distinction of the craftsman, that each kind plies its own craft by itself and mixes not with another. And the class of the shepherds and hunters and of husbandmen are set apart. And that of the warriors, too, you have surely noticed, is here sundered from all other classes, for they are expected to study the art of war and nothing else. Again, there is the custom of arming with spears and shields, wherewith we have been the first men in Asia to arm ourselves, for the goddess taught this to us as she did first to you in that country of yours. Again, as regards knowledge, you see how cautious our law is in its underlying principles, examining the laws of nature till it arrives at divination and medicine, the object of which is health, drawing from those divine studies lessons useful for human requirements and adding to these all the allied sciences. Thus the goddess established you. Now, I know you're hung up on this goddess bit. Now, let's just keep going. Thus the goddess established you when she founded your nation first, fixing the spot in which ye were born, because she saw that the equal temperament of its seasons would render its people most intelligent. As the goddess was a patroness of war and erudition, she selected the place that should produce men resembling herself, and in it she planted your race. Thus then did she dwell, or thus then did ye dwell, governed by such laws as I have described, and even better still, surpassing all men in excellence. Many and mighty. Still hung up on our goddess bit, aren't you? Well, I'm telling you, if God's a man, and we shall all be like him, you women livers are eventually going to lose. And the devil has all the traits of a woman. The devil's problem started when he had looked in the mirror. All I'm really doing is pointing out your traditional reaction to reject anything immediately that refers to supreme being as Goddess. separate the story from the goddess for the time being, and let me proceed with your mind still with me. Many and mighty are the deeds of your city set down for the admiration of humanity. And there is one which for greatness and nobility surpasses all the rest. For our chronicles, now these are chronicles kept in Egypt, if this priest is telling the truth. Or if Solon told the truth, and if Croesus is telling the truth, and if Plato's telling the truth, and didn't just make this up. If Plato made this up, you can rationalize all you want about him doing it as an allegory. The man was a damn fraud. And yet, universally, the world is ready to accept and give credence to Plato for his contributions to philosophic thought. I'm going to pay attention to Plato. Let's keep going. Many and mighty are the deeds of your city. This Egyptian telling about an ancient Athens. An Athens of prehistory, as the Athenians knew it, because they only remembered one deluge. And he talks of an Athens way back yonder, for which many mighty deeds are recorded about for the admiration of humanity. But there is one which for greatness and nobility surpasses all the rest. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Probably as many books have been written about Atlantis as any subject. This is just one of the thousands of books by Lewis Spence, entitled The History of Atlantis. Just about every book on Atlantis makes its own special contribution. The best contribution of this particular book is a compilation from many translations of Plato's works of the dialogue regarding Atlantis in a more modern, understandable language, like a Phillips translation of the Bible or an E.B. Rue translation of the New Testament, which puts it in street language. And I'm reading this compilation of translations of Atlantis. I used to ride airplanes a lot before I came here. Traveled for years. Many times I'd fly on an airplane wearing a suit, have to get off the airplane and immediately go speak somewhere without time to change. So I used to go on an airplane many times. I'd be dozing in my seat and I'd take my suit coat off and turn it around backwards and put my arms through it and wear it backwards. That way it didn't wrinkle. If you put it on right, you can wear the coat and you're sitting there with the, you know, you look like somebody turned your head around. Which reminds me of the story of the guy that was riding a motorcycle one night, real cold. In his prison, he decided the way to solve his problem was to turn his leather jacket around so the wind wouldn't whistle through the buttons. So he turned the jacket around, driving down the road, and had an accident, went in the ditch. The guy that was right behind him immediately skidded to a stop and ran over to the motorcycle. And the car that was about 100 yards, 200 yards back also stopped. He ran over and found the first guy that was following the motorcycle standing over him, the guy on the motorcycle. And so the second guy said to the first guy that arrived at the scene, "Well, is the motorcycle rider hurt?" And the first guy that arrived on the scene says, you know, it's the funniest thing I ever saw. He seemed to be all right till I straightened his head out. I'm sure that a lot of stewardesses had that urge with me. But I saw one of them looking at me kind of funny on a plane one day. I said, I always wear it this way. That's a look I will never forget. To you watching for the first time, always wear two sets of glasses like this. That's the point of all that. Now I'm well into this story where the priest in Egypt is telling the visitor from Athens how really stupid the Athenians are. You know, they think it's a big deal to remember one deluge. And they haven't kept records. And so he is telling them about his own city. This Egyptian priest is telling the visitor from Athens about his own city, records having been kept in Egypt. And he says, many and mighty are the deeds of your city set down for the admiration of humanity. But there is one which for greatness and nobility surpasses all the rest. For our chronicles tell of a great adversary, your city conquered of old, a power which advanced in wanton insolence upon all Europe and Asia together, issuing yonder from the Atlantic Ocean. For in those days the sea there could be crossed, since it had an island before the mouth of the strait, which is called, as ye say, the Pillars of Hercules. Now this island was greater than Libya and Asia together. Now in those days, Egypt was considered a part of Asia. And literally he meant Asia Minor. Now this island was greater than Libya, North Africa, and Asia, Egypt, and the Levant, together. And therefrom there was a passage for the seafarers of those times to the other islands. So outside what is now Gibraltar, then the Pillars of Hercules, was a great island bigger than North Africa, Egypt, and the Palestinian area combined. Beyond that, other islands. And from the islands, beyond the big island, to all the opposite continent, which bounds that ocean, truly named Atlantic. That's what makes it so ridiculous to try to identify Atlantis with a volcanic explosion in Tyra, an island in the Mediterranean, or some of the other ridiculous locations. Plato is very clear.
This is the end of side one.